The Bible Study on KFUO Radio is underwritten by Concordia Seminary, St. Louis, centered in the gospel of Jesus Christ in faithfulness, servanthood, responsiveness, and excellence, Concordia Seminary.
Hour number two of the Bible Study, the Ask the Pastor Hour. Open phones, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. This hour of conversation features Dr. Rick Mars, professor at Concordia Seminary here in St. Louis. Made the walk down the road here with his umbrella and his raincoat and stayed pretty dry. Did you make it?
Yes, but I was carrying my umbrella with just one hand at one point, and then the wind gust caught it and whacked it upside my head.
So oh, well.
Not too hard, but woke me up a little.
Are you okay?
Yeah, I'm all right. I'm at least conscious for you to talk to.
Very good. Because if you start not making sense, I'm going to have to say, uh-oh, the umbrella did us in here. Well, it's good to have you here, and happy to be able to discuss some things. You indicated that you had listened to the previous hour in the conversation with Pastor Metter. I want to talk about that a little bit. But tell me, what are you teaching? I guess this quarter is ending now.
We just finished on Friday with the last quarter, where I was teaching a pastor's counselor course, which is my typical sort of load, and an intro to pastoral ministry class. So I got the very first year guys to get their first class in as to the whole kind of range of what they were going to learn in seminary and what they should be learning about over the next 3 or 4 years. So.
And you have a degree in
psychology. Well, and an MDiv from Concordia Seminary, but then a PhD in counseling psychology from Loyola University in Chicago, and licensed as a psychologist in Illinois.
If there's somebody listening to us right now and says to himself, you know what, I really wish I could avail myself of some good counseling.
Mm-hmm.
And I know my pastor pretty well, and I'm just not confident that he would be very good at the counseling task.
Right.
Are you here to tell us that all the graduates with the Master of Divinity degree or the ones that come out of Concordia Seminary are competent, even gifted counselors?
They are, I hope, going to be good Seelsorgers.
Seelsorgers.
Yes, that's the word we tend to use. It's the old German term for soul healer. And that's what pastors have been for 2,000 years before the field of psychology was ever invented. Pastors have been often the go-to guy for people who were struggling with emotional, spiritual, psychological sorts of issues. And for people that are Christians in congregations, I think they should go to their pastor for at least some initial consultation on those things. And the vast majority of time, or a great majority of times, I won't say vast, but a great majority of times, they may be having particular issues that the pastor is not trained in, and hopefully then he can refer them on to some appropriate counselor that he has met and talked with and gotten to know and feels comfortable with sending them to this particular counselor, either because they're a Christian who does good counseling or because they are even a non-Christian that specializes in a particular area and is respectful of the Christian faith and won't turn them against their Lord in the counseling process. And again, pastors have a responsibility to check those things out, and we spend an entire hour and a half, two-hour class period just talking to students about here's all the details you need to do once you get to your parish to find out about who the good counselors are.
Usually when a term like Seelsorge, which is German, right,
mm-hmm.
is used, it's because we haven't really come up with a very good English word to supplant it that captures the essence of what it means.
Right.
So, since you don't have a very good English word,
soul healer or
soul
cure.
Healer.
Yeah, those are kind of the ways that the term, it's also an old Latin term back before it was a German term. So,
In the Bible, we're told that Jesus had compassion on people.
Right.
The word compassion is sometimes defined as something that comes from the gut.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of you feel it.
Splagna. Yeah.
What is that?
Splagna.
What is that?
Splagnidzimai.
Is that German too?
No, that's Greek.
That's Greek.
That's for the gut. So we tend to put emotions up in our heart, in our chest, and say, you know, I love you with all my heart. The Greeks put it down lower.
Is there some splagna in Seelsorge?
Yeah. I mean, that's what pastors, I try to convince pastors they are not to be simply walking, talking theological encyclopedias. They are human beings with their own struggles, and they're sharing in those struggles and with the griefs. I mean, when a loved one dies, very few people go to see a professional psychologist about that, at least in the first week. When a loved one dies, they go to see their pastor, because the pastor is the one who has God's word on the answers to life and death and the assurance of where this loved one, who, assuming that they trusted in Jesus, has gone to heaven and will be waiting for the resurrection of the dead, just like they are waiting for the resurrection of the dead. And that's more important than what any psychologist can do in the first few weeks. So
I can see if a man, for example, is his marriage has fallen apart. He's got a divorce. I'm not going to say whether he initiated it or was victimized by it, but now he's a divorced man. He's feeling guilty that the marriage failed. He's feeling guilty about his contribution to that failure. He goes to see his pastor. He confesses his sins. The pastor forgives him. I can see where there's some Seelsorge in that. But there's another set of circumstances. Let's say a man has a teenage son, and the teenage son has gotten in with the wrong crowd, and they found drugs in the boy's knapsack, his backpack, and as far as the dad is concerned, you know, they've done everything right. They raised the child in the church. They took the child to confirmation. They don't know why this is happening. There's no real sin to confess here. I mean, we might uncover something along the way, but really this person needs counseling because he's got a big problem in his life that that he didn't really create with his neglect. You got something for that guy, Pastor? You're going to send him on to Dr. Rick Mars, the professional psychologist.
Well, and I tend not to see lay people at this point myself personally. I do some counseling with pastors, but the seminary keeps me busy enough. I don't keep a
private practice
going.
Well, I was using it figuratively.
Okay, figuratively, yes. You send them on to a psychologist. But, it would be good to send him on to somebody who he could talk to about, you know, what could I have done better? But again, it sounds like maybe even this father could be feeling some guilt about what didn't I do right with my son.
Anytime you have a child go south on you, you're going to feel guilty.
And in some cases, the son may be feeling some guilt. Why am I trapped in this sin? Why am I trapped in this use of drugs? I wish I could get out of it, but I'm kind of sucked back into it every time I try to leave. There is where pastors can have some very real Seelsorge work in reconciling families together in the gospel and bringing forgiveness to them. That doesn't mean that there won't be follow-up need for drug abuse counseling. If this young man or young woman are somehow addicted to the drugs that they've been using, they're going to need some follow-up first article, you know, human created order sorts of things that they need to address. But I think that there's almost always second article, that is, things that have to do with Jesus and forgiveness that are wrapped into all of the psychological problems that we have in this world.
I'm wondering if it might not be possible that there are circumstances which, in one case, really do prevail upon the pastor and his skills learned at the seminary, having gone through Dr. Rick Marr's course, pastor as counselor, and father confessor, and empowered by the word of God to offer absolution in the name of God. And then there are another set of circumstances that really do prevail upon the expertise of the psychologist.
Right.
And that those two things may, in some circumstances, not even overlap. So that if you're in the pastor's office when you really need a psychologist, or you're in the psychologist's office when you really need a pastor, you could invest a lot of time and energy in the wrong place and be worse for the investment.
Well, and that's why I think pastors and psychologists, pastors and counselors need to be talking with each other on these things. And I say that, and I've got one counselor I've been trying to talk to for a few weeks, and we've been missing each other on phone tag and everything. But pastors and counselors should be working together on these various issues.
What's it going to look like when somebody comes into the pastor and confesses privately things to the pastor that, well, you can't share that with the psychologist? I mean, you're bound by the confessional there to keep all that private.
Right, unless the client, unless the parishioner says, I think this would be beneficial to me if the two of you were talking. And so if the client parishioner gives permission to both the counselor and the pastor to do that, then they are free to consult with each other and be helpful to each other and whatever. Because, again, the counselor is going to hear some things that the psychologist isn't going to know and be eye-opening for him. And the pastor is going to know, did I say that right? The counselor is going to know some things that the pastor is not going to know, and the pastor is going to know some things that the counselor would never have access to because it just wouldn't come up in a regular sort of session. So things about the family and about how the person interacts with the congregation as a whole, those things are new news to a counselor that they might really want some access to. So I think the two can work well together, and it's a wonderful, blessed thing when the two occupations, two vocations do work well together.
There are probably people listening, maybe a lot of people listening to us right now, who say to themselves, I've never been to my pastor to talk about any of these kinds of things, and I've never been to a psychologist. Come on, man up. What's happening to us as a people? I mean, holy cow, we got to have psychologists and crying on our pastor's shoulder. Are we that weak? I've never done it, and I can't imagine that I ever would.
Well,
what do you have to say to that person?
That going to see and talk to somebody. I mean, we all go and consult with friends if we're struggling with something. I mean, nearly everybody would feel, you know, if they had a friend that they...
Personal confidant.
Right, that they felt comfortable with and trusted. There are just some circumstances where it may be beneficial to go to talk to somebody who has greater expertise and has more experience in these things. We go to see other specialists in other areas of our lives. We don't think that we're... This is my physical body, and it's mine, but I don't think that I'm as much of an expert on some of what might be going on inside of it as a medical doctor would. These are my teeth, and they're mine for the rest of my life, but I'm not as expert as my dentist is. Why wouldn't we be open to at least occasionally going and getting a checkup with the pastor?
Well, I know the answer to that, because as you well know, we wait until our bodies just can't move anymore, or our teeth are falling out of our heads before we got a toothache that we can't stand before we go to see either one of those.
Well, guys. And even, you know, Roman Catholics have rules about, you know, Catholics should go to their father confessor at least once a year, and in various other times I think it's been more frequent than that. For their confession absolution. I'm not saying, you know, we Lutherans don't make laws, a canon law or anything about those things, but I would think a lot of people would be benefited by going and having a checkup once a year with a counselor, going and doing private confession with their pastor at least once a year. Those things can be very, very beneficial to our souls, healing to our souls, and that's where that whole term souls healer comes back to. So.
Now, in our previous conversation with Pastor Nathan Metter in Romans chapter 11, we were talking about the elect, we were talking about ethnic Israel, those descended from Abraham by the flesh, we were talking about faithful Israel, those descended from Abraham based on the promise, based on faith in the promise, we're talking about the fullness of the Gentiles coming, all that stuff, and you heard the why are some saved and not always, and not all saved question in that conversation triggered some thinking on your part. What went through your mind?
Yeah, I read a book by another psychologist. I kind of joke with my colleagues at the seminary that I tend to read different books than they do. They're reading all these theological books, and then I'm reading books somewhat in theology, but also in psychology and such. Paul Vitz is a psychologist, a Catholic psychologist who used to be the chair of the department at New York University, and he's written an interesting book called Faith of the Fatherless, The Psychology of Atheism. I know at least earlier in my life when I was kind of struggling with issues of doubt and wondering, you know, does God really exist? Is he like the God that the Bible describes and all those sorts of things? There were psychologists who were making some pretty, I mean, not just psychologists, but other atheists, but a lot of them psychologists, who were making some pretty strong arguments against belief in God. And I was having to read a lot of these books. And so B.F. Skinner and Albert Ellis and some of these guys were having some influence, but even other, and Freud and such, but even other atheists were having some influence. And they all seemed very, very...
All those men you just mentioned were atheists?
Yes. Okay. So, and pretty much wrote, they were kind of the Sam Harris and Christopher Hitchens of their day, the popular atheists that are out there today.
Outspoken atheists.
Very outspoken atheists, writing books against belief in God and such. Freud wrote several books on that. Totem and Taboo is one that where he tried to explain away, you know, our belief in God just came about because we had unresolved father issues, and if we had those father issues resolved, we wouldn't believe in God anymore, was Freud's kind of take on that. Well, Witz decided to, again, a very fairly well-known psychologist, well-written psychologist, decided to do some exploration into the early childhood histories of all these various atheists from of old, people like Nietzsche and Freud, Voltaire, Schopenhauer, Hobbes, Feuerbach, H.G. Wells, and even Madeline Murray O'Hare and Albert Ellis. And he went and explored their early childhood histories. And again, these are some of the most well-written, highly respected intellects of their time and even going on into today. They're the philosophers and stuff that people still read in the history of philosophy. And Witz found out that nearly every one of them had issues with their fathers growing up. They were either abandoned by their father at an early age, before age 5 or 6, or their father died at that time, or they had an abusive or neglectful or somehow weak father in some other way. Although the bulk of them, it was no father at all. And he sort of explored then this hypothesis by Freud that these people, you know, Freud saying we have unresolved father issues and that's why we believe in God. Witz has actually come back with a hypothesis. Well, it looks to him like, from doing a psychological history of these men and some women, that maybe they had unresolved father issues, which then led them into their atheism. And I just found this very insightful, and I've shared it with some of my colleagues at the seminary, and they're going, wow, you know, because we often spend a lot of time and energy speaking logically against the atheists that are out there in the world, and that's an important thing to do, to counter their arguments, to defend the gospel, do apologetics, and explain why a belief in God is a logical thing to follow. But this kind of an approach at least turns that on its head, because a lot of the atheists try to argue that we Christians are weak-minded in some way, that we've got these unresolved, you know, childhood issues that we're trying to get at with our belief in God and fanciful beliefs in God, as they would say. But in reality, if this hypothesis by Witz is true, then maybe it's not us that having the unresolved childhood issues, but those, again, and Witz doesn't go so far as to say all atheists have early childhood issues. He's just saying when he's looked at the historical biographies of these most prominent 15 or so historical atheists from the 1600s and on, partly because atheism was like non-existent prior to about 1600.
You haven't looked at Christopher Hitchens, have you?
I did do a Wikipedia search on him this morning.
Really?
He didn't have the happiest childhood. This was a fairly quick thing that I did. But, he described his father as an imperialistic, purse-lipped, and silent commander of the HMS Jamaica. His father's naval career required the family to move and reside in a variety of different places around the world. And his mother was going to argue that if there's going to be an upper class in this country, Christopher is going to be in it. And
now,
he was... Well-educated.
When you began reading this book, and the man, Witz, says, you know, atheists have said maybe the problem here is that people who believe in God had bad father experience, and so they needed to create or manufacture some father God that would take the place of their bad father. But maybe the reverse is true.
Right.
Maybe the truth is that atheists have come from a place with somebody who had a bad father figure, and so that drove them to their atheism. Mm-hmm. When you are reading this, do you say to yourself, wow, I never thought about that. That is an interesting hypothesis. Or are you more likely to think something like, it's exactly what I've been thinking all along?
Well, yeah, I would say I was somewhere in between. I at least had pondered before. I wonder what their childhoods were like, you know, but I hadn't seen anything that actually tried to do an overall history of them. Because I am a psychologist, always wondering what sort of, you know, early childhood experiences might be influencing people. And again, sometimes that's very true and sometimes it's not. Sometimes it's things that have happened to us in the last 5 years that are really our emotional struggles, and we had a very, very happy childhood. But this was just an intriguing thing that, again, Witt says that it seems to be a combination of deep intellect and frustration with fathers that may actually lead these well-known atheists into the kind of rabid atheism. Again, there's lots of other atheists out there that are just kind of agnostic or atheist, and they don't go after the Christian faith. They're not zealous atheists like these 15 or so were. And again, Witz would probably say that there might not necessarily be any early childhood issues with those people. Those people just became convinced because of other cultural factors or their education led them toward the road of atheism. But at least with these 15, and the interesting thing was he went and compared about 15 similarly popular men in those time periods, like William Wilberforce, Samuel Wilberforce, Soren Kierkegaard, Chesterton, Schweitzer, Bonhoeffer, Mendelssohn, Schleiermacher, and those men who were also equally kind of well known as academics and philosophers and such, had relatively happy childhoods and didn't have issues with their father. Their fathers had treated them well.
So what's your opinion? Do you think we have a valid trend emerging here? Or, I mean, at some point you have to say that predictability becomes fact. And I guess you have to do a lot of research before you can put the fact word on it. But what do you think?
Well, I throw this out there for listeners and find it kind of intriguing, especially in light of your past discussion of why some and not others. Again, these atheists have been some of those that have influenced our world immensely in the last 200 years to make us a more doubting, more unbelieving kind of society. And at least to know that, okay, some of this stems from not just pure logic that these men and women were trying to use, including Madeline Murray O'Hare, who was a popular atheist in the last generation. She apparently had horrendous experiences with her father.
Well, this is good news because this is, you know, as an atheist, if I'm an atheist, and I find myself standing with the other goat atheists there on that great day of the Lord, I think I'll be put in a position where I can point my bony atheist finger in the face of God the Father and say, this is not my fault. Mm-hmm. Look at all those sheep over there that you gave good fathers and good home life to growing up. And us, you gave us dysfunctional, imperious, purse-lipped fathers, and it's not my fault. It's your fault. Is that where we're headed here?
Well, I don't think that necessarily, because, again, there are a lot of people that had unhappy childhoods who do turn to Christ and do repent of their sins, not the sins that were committed against them when they were 3 years old, but the sins that they continue to be entrapped by throughout their lifetime. And so I think everybody has an opportunity to, Christ gives them through the Holy Spirit the opportunity to be called to the gospel. But that's where I get back to then some verses like, 1 Peter 3:15. Always be prepared to give an answer to those who question you about the hope that is in you, but do so with gentleness and respect. As we are having Christian conversations or conversations about Christ with our friends who are agnostic and atheists, maybe we should hold back on the venom. We should hold back on the venom. We should hold back on the intensity and gently, respectfully love them into, because they maybe have had these bad experiences. We'll come back.
All right, you're listening to the Bible Study. Dr. Rick Mars is with us here today, professor at Concordia Seminary in St. Louis. And in the next half hour, I want to talk about Fred Phelps. You heard about him?
Do we have to?
Yeah, just a little bit.
I've heard business people complain that nonprofits don't respond in timely ways to needs and opportunities. I believe that's true. Concordia Seminary strives to instill responsiveness in our graduates. Responsiveness to the needs of congregations and responsiveness to the needs of our communities and world. Responsiveness is a seminary core value, and it's a Great Commission value.
It's the Builder's Home and Garden Show, 5 complete shows in one. You'll see lawn and garden, pool and spa, kitchen and bath, interior design and building products, enormous feature gardens, local and national celebrity speakers, and family fun areas, just a few of the reasons to attend the 2011 Home and Garden Show at the Edward Jones Dome. It's happening the week of March 3rd. Don't miss it. The Home and Garden Show at the Edward Jones Dome.
This is Life Issues with Brad Mattis, Executive Director of Life Issues Institute.
By now, hopefully you've heard about the many Planned Parenthood abortion mills caught on video aiding an underage sex ring. A woman and man posing as a prostitute and her boss filmed their encounters with Planned Parenthood staff. The undercover video showed the staff assisting the human trafficking of teens. They helped them secure secret abortions and treatments for sexually transmitted diseases. This comes at a time when Congress is looking for ways to cut spending. Planned Parenthood gets over $350 million tax dollars a year, and they're clearly using it to break the law and victimize our children. If you'd like to watch the videos, visit today's broadcast link at lifeissues.org. While there, sign on to an effort to demand Congress stop funding Planned Parenthood.
Life Issues. Stay informed. More informed than you've ever been.
Pirates and Prayers. I'm Steve Coleman with today's Religion Roundup. Four Americans aboard a yacht that has sailed the world distributing Bibles have been hijacked by Somali pirates. A weekend prayer service was held at St. Monica's Catholic Church in Santa Monica, California for Scott and Jean Adam, owners of the sailing vessel Quest. Monsignor Lloyd Torgerson says the Adams are longtime members of his church.
They had this time after in their retirement to spend some time going across this world and bringing Bibles, bringing the scriptures, bringing the word of God to people, and they did it in the most remote places of this world, and that was their mission, that was their hope.
Organizers of an international yacht race called the Blue Water Rally identified the other two Americans on board the Quest as Phyllis McKay and Bob Riggle, who are from Seattle. Two pirates and a Somali official say the yacht was hijacked Friday off of Oman and was being sailed to Puntland, a haven for pirates in Somalia. I'm Steve Coleman.
Nominate your LCMS church to be a KFUO Radio Church of the Week. The contest drawing is March 4th. The winning entry receives exclusive identification as the KFUO Radio Church of the Week for any available 7-day period, Sunday through Saturday. Inclusion as the Church of the Week in every hourly 10-second station identification announcement. 35 30-second prime time, 7 a.m. to 5 p.m. announcements, 5 per day, identifying your congregation, your address, and your phone number. Oh, your pastor or a church member may record the announcements if you like. And your pastor gets to be a co-host on the KFUO Radio Morning Show. And if you submit the winning entry, you'll receive a $100 gift certificate and a $100 gift certificate for your pastor. Get details on the KFUO website and spread the word to nominate your LCMS church to be a KFUO Radio Church of the Week.
Dr. Rick Mars is with us here today. He's a trained psychologist, had a psychology practice before he decided to enter the seminary and become a pastor, eventually a professor at Concordia Seminary. And that qualifies him to discuss some of the things we're talking about here in a way that many of the rest of us do not qualify. Our numbers are 505-7850-1800-730-2727. So you were on your way to finishing up a couple of thoughts there.
Yeah, and again, a lot of this, I think, this discussion about, you know, many of the atheists of old that had issues with their fathers, according to Witz. And it wasn't just the philosophers and psychologists that I mentioned earlier, but he also spends a chapter on Stalin, Hitler, and Mao Zedong. So probably more people have died in the past century under those three men than have died under any other three men in history. And all three of them were beaten by their fathers. So they had horrific childhoods where child abuse was rampant. And then he goes on to show, well, could that be an explanation as to why these men then abused so many of the people that were under them as kind of a response to their childhood abuse. But so anyway, I wanted to at least take this for the listeners as Christians to realize, not that we're doing a, you shouldn't go up to your atheist friend or relative or agnostic now that you've heard this, and even if you go out and read Witz's book, you shouldn't just go up and say, oh, well, now I know why you're an atheist, because you had a bad childhood, and you and I both know how bad your father was. Or
that would
all
be
that.
Bad technique.
That would be
it?
Very bad technique. So please, listeners, do not do anything
like
that.
Glad you told me that. I've been guilty of some bad technique along the way.
But what it does, I think, show us as Christians who are trying to share the word, you know, the 1 Peter 3:15 that I was talking about, always be prepared to give an answer to those who question you about the hope that is in you, but do so with gentleness and respect. And then just before that, Peter wrote in 1 Peter 2:11 and 12, beloved, I urge you as sojourners and exiles to abstain from the passions of the flesh which wage war against your soul. Keep your conduct among the Gentiles honorable, so that when they speak against you as evildoers, they may see your good deeds and glorify God on the day of visitation. As we continue to live holy lives, hallowing God's name as Christians, and they see that, and then we have gentle and respectful, loving conversations with them where we are trying to draw them into the love of Christ by the peace and joy and love that they see in our lives, then maybe they will be drawn, because they have that yearning need for God the Father in their lives and for the forgiveness of Jesus Christ, that as they see that in our lives, that they may be drawn at least into more conversations. You probably won't, you know, just convince your atheist friend in the first half-hour conversation that you have with him, but there have been lots of experiences or people have had where they spend hours talking to an atheist or agnostic friend, and then maybe a year later something happens in that friend's life, or a year later they see something that happens in the Christian's life, you know, the husband dies, or, you know, a child dies, and they see how we react with grief, but a grief that is in hope in Jesus Christ, and they desire that for themselves and are drawn to it, and the Holy Spirit is working on their lives through what we're saying to them. So
with no psychological background or training,
mm-hmm.
at least it feels to me like I can kind of understand how a boy who is has a father who, first of all, doesn't give him a very good example of masculinity or right. how a man ought to behave, that is missing. And then what's in its place is maybe abuse, maybe physical violence.
Anger.
I don't think you have to be a Rhodes Scholar to figure out the combination of those two things is going to make you screwed up.
Right. Right.
And may help explain why down the road some behavior is pathological, why some behavior is violent, aggressive, and maybe even leads to the kind of tyranny that we see in an Adolf Hitler.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay, I can get a handle on that.
Mm-hmm.
What's the theological assessment of it? That's the psychological part, and I think I can even sort of see that.
Mm-hmm.
What's the theological ramification here for a young boy who is absent of a strong godly father figure and has in its place instead a wicked and violent father figure? Mm-hmm. What are the theological implications?
Or even a missing father figure, yeah. because he's died or something, so, or abandoned the family. I mean, for us, it's probably, you know, how can we reach out to children of various ages who we think could be helped with a stronger father figure? You know, could More Christian men be involved in groups like Big Brothers, Christian women and Big Sisters, for children that are in single-parent families that maybe need that parenting model. Again, God created us as human beings to be parented. I mean, Adam and Eve apparently were on their own because he was their father directly. But then they were the father to their children. And again, something happened that they didn't do as good a job as they might have, because then you got the whole Cain and Abel story. But sin was rampant within that second generation. But, honor your father and your mother is the fourth commandment, and is arguably the most important of the second table of the law commandments. If we keep the fourth commandment, then we're probably not going to kill anybody or do all the other things that are in the sixth through tenth commandments, at least as badly. It's important to have godly parent figures. That does not necessarily mean that it has to be your biological parent who is that parent figure. So can Christian men in congregations, if they know of a young boy who doesn't have a father, can they be a father figure to him? And then again, lots of reports from congregations where they look up to elders of the church who did kind of take them under their wing at various ages and stages of their lives.
505-7850 and 1-800-730-2727. Good morning, Brian. You're on the Bible study.
I would just want to make a comment. I think that Vitz book is very good. I've read that. I think another interesting book is a book called Intellectuals, which is by the British historian Paul Johnson.
Mm-hmm.
And they're short little essays on these different major intellectual figures of the 19th and 20th century. And he sees a theme running through of it. A lot of them did have kind of a atheistic orientation. And the premise in the book is that what it is kind of an intellectual snobbery. And I do find with a lot of these atheists, especially the new ones, that snobbery seems to be something, the new home snobbery is not, whether you have better spoons than your neighbor now. It's, whether your ideas are better or whether your beliefs are more intellectual or not. And I see this with Christopher Hitchens and a lot of these guys. They all grew up in the 60s. And their whole thing was being against authority.
Right.
And who's the ultimate authority?
Yep.
So that's who's in their crosshairs, and that's the way they can sell books.
Okay. Thank you, Brian. Yeah. Pastor, is snobbery a psychological or a theological term?
Well, and I think even the last thing that the caller said, I think that's very important about authority and how we address authority. That's where the Fourth Commandment comes into it, and if we want to reject all authority...
The Fourth Commandment really is all about authority, isn't it?
Right. It's not just about two parents. It's about parents and other authorities, as Luther says in the Small Catechism. So it's how we treat government, it's how we treat police, it's how we think about others intellectually. If you're willing to throw out everything of previous generations' authority and what they've written, it does lend a little bit of snobbery. Now, again, we have to watch out for how we Christians do it as well. Stanton Jones, the provost at Wheaton College, a friend of mine that has written a number of psychology articles in the secular psychology realm, and he calls for everybody to have more epistemic humility. That is, humility about what
Another
we know.
Another big word.
Yeah, sorry.
Epistemic.
I'll explain it.
Oh, good.
Humility about what we know and what we don't know. And, again, a lot of us tend to think, oh, I'm so smart, I can convince you of everything that I know, and that's all you need to know. But there's just a lot of stuff that's mysterious and unknown out there, how God created the world. And we're trying to fill that in. You and I had this conversation a little bit before with our culture's trying to fill it in with evolution. But nobody knows how all that happened. I mean, not all the details. We Christians...
Public broadcasting
the Bible
system
and say,
knows.
Well, yeah,
PBS knows. Nova, they know.
They won't know if they get defunded, but that's another issue.
Here's another caller at 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Harold, you're on the Bible study.
My reception is pretty, if you can speak very loud, I'm hard of hearing. Mylon and Mary O'Hara, for years ago we heard that her son became a Christian and began to go about to testifying to his faith and that. And I was just wondering, I don't hear about him anymore, And are there children, examples of children of other atheists who have become Christians?
Hmm.
All right, we'll talk about it. Thanks for the call.
That's a good question. I don't know about that. I do know that the son has been, is a Christian, and I guess his mother just disappeared. We don't know what happened to her, at least last I looked. That we don't know where she died or anything like that. But I did, in the brief little research that I did on Christopher Hitchens, he has a brother, his only brother, who is a Orthodox evangelical Christian, and the two of them have had some public disagreements about issues, and I don't know if they're talking to each other now, but there have been time periods that they haven't, and I pray that his brother can reach out to him, because as many of us know, Christopher Hitchens is struggling with cancer at this time and may not have a lot more time left on this world, but not just him, all others that are unbelievers.
505-7850, 1-800-730-2727 if you want to join the conversation. Hi, James, you're on the Bible study.
Yes, Pastor, please help me with this, I guess, incomplete epiphany that I'm having about this subject that you are talking about.
Wait a minute, incomplete epiphany.
Incomplete epiphany.
All right, I'm gonna wrestle with that. Go ahead.
I got him.
Okay.
Okay, does the issue that is sung about in the Harry Chapin song, Cats in the Cradle, mm-hmm. where the father is well-intended, indicate that the son may turn to atheism? And if so, is there a cycle, since the son really wants to be like his father, is there the danger of a cycle of atheism coming out of a common situation like that? Because we have a lot of workaholic, not abusive fathers, mm-hmm. but well-intended, busy, workaholic type of fathers. So could you comment on that?
Yeah. All right, thanks for the call. The Harry Chapin song he's talking about, famous generation ago,
Cats in the Cradle,
where written from the singer's perspective, the father is absent and the singer needs the father, and mm-hmm. so but it never happens, and so the singer grows up, becomes a father, and finds out he's exactly like his father was,
right.
In a regrettable way. So go ahead, take the question.
Well, yeah, I like that he's brought this up. How do I want to answer it? I do think that we Christian fathers probably are more prone to being like that. We don't necessarily abuse our children or something, but we kind of do leave their emotional upbringing too much to mothers or teachers and don't step in and be the fathers that we should. Paul writes, fathers, do not exasperate your children, but bring them up in the fear of the Lord. That doesn't mean beat them or, make them afraid of God, but bring them up in the belief that God is their loving parent. And they can only, well, not only, but they can get that better if they have a father who reaches out, spends time with them, talks to them about their own lives, gives them advice about the next steps of their lives, does what fathers can and should do and have done from eternity. We get some good examples of biblical fathers who did moderately good jobs with their sons, but all fathers are going to mess up also. Abraham messed up with Isaac, and Isaac messed up with Jacob and Esau, and, we are going to make mistakes. But even when we make mistakes, can we go to those children and say, I'm sorry, would you please forgive me for, what I did, what I didn't do? And even in that asking for forgiveness, we're modeling the Christian life for that child and how they should step into their parenthood and model that Christian life for the next generation.
I really want to, in spite of your reluctance, I really want to...
do we have to?
Yeah. Fred Phelps is the father figure in the Westboro Baptist Church.
Yeah.
And my understanding is that most of the members of the Westboro Baptist Church are part of Fred Phelps' extended family.
Right.
It is probably unfair to refer to them as Baptists.
Right.
They're whatever it is that they confess seems to be more coming from Fred Phelps than it mm-hmm. is from any Baptist denomination. In any case, mm-hmm. we know that the Westboro Baptist Church and those affiliated with Fred Phelps go to funeral situations. They go to situations where most of the rest of us can tell that this is a moment that requires the highest level of sensitivity that we can come up with. And they bring the highest level of insensitivity that they can muster to those situations.
Right.
And we've talked about Fred and his family's activities in the past from a theological perspective. How does this fit with love your neighbor, things like that.
And I know nothing about Fred Phelps' early childhood, just so we're clear on that, although I guess I would like to know something about his early childhood.
Well, in the context of father figures and what that means to those who come after the father, the children, the grandchildren, from a distance, as a psychologist, as you observe the activities of the Westboro Baptist, can you speak to that as a psychologist? What are you seeing? What kind of questions would you like to ask and answer? I'm not asking Dr. Mars the theologian. I'm asking Dr. Mars the psychologist. What's going on?
Well, because I actually do have a little more pastoral experience with them. The parish that I served in Kansas was just about 50 miles away from Topeka, where they're centered.
Right.
And so I would go to events in Topeka, even LCMS church events at Topeka, and they would be picketing us at our churches because we weren't bashing homosexuals enough for them. Again, anybody that knows the theology of the LCMS, we do say very publicly that homosexual behavior is sinful behavior and that people should repent of that and stop doing it, and then they will be forgiven by God. Apparently, our emphasis on forgiveness for that behavior the gospel is not enough for Fred Phelps and his group. And so they actually picket our churches in Topeka and other places in Kansas for not being more publicly against it like they are.
So how does the psychologist explain that?
Oh, gosh. Again,
there is no explanation?
No,
psychological?
I don't know enough. Like I said, I wish I knew something about his early childhood. I wish I knew something about what was happening inside their church services and inside their family that would lead such a high percentage of his family.
You suspect
that
there's a psychological root here?
I would think so, that it's just such manipulativeness.
Some people are just nuts, right?
Well, yeah, there's personality disorders, and I think there's a lot of narcissism going on in this particular man. And
narcissism?
Yeah, self... an overly self-focused that thinks I'm always right and I can't be wrong, and not necessarily an antisocial behavior because he's not going out and killing people, but this is about as antisocial of narcissistic behavior that I can imagine. And it is perplexing as to how he has gotten such a high percentage of apparently relatively intelligent children and grandchildren to follow in, because they somehow get into law school and become lawyers, at least a high percentage of them. So.
Well, I didn't just bring this up for fun. This
is
in the news today.
Right. Today, I haven't seen that.
This is an interesting thing, and I thought the psychologist might have something to say here. Maybe not. I don't know. But a group of hacktivists, they're called hacktivists, acting under the banner Anonymous, has warned the Westboro Baptist Church and its controversial history that unspoken retribution will follow it if it continues its practice of inflammatory protest. In an open letter to the Westboro Baptist Church, Anonymous has put the anti-gay fundamentalist church on notice that the damage incurred will be irreversible and that neither your institution nor your congregation will ever be able to fully recover. The Westboro Baptist Church, led by Reverend Fred Phelps, it has drawn particular attention for carrying out anti-gay protests at funerals of military servicemen with signs celebrating the deaths of soldiers. And in a letter, Anonymous, whoever that is, or whatever that is, wrote, they recently made headlines when they got into a computer system of a security firm and posted thousands of documents describing plans to attack WikiLeaks, the Bank of America, and U.S. Chamber of Commerce, etc., etc. So, nothing seems to have been able to stop Fred Phelps. Nobody's been able to make a theological argument or a Baptist argument or a Christian argument to get him to stop doing this.
Or a legal argument or
now
anything.
Now somebody who is unnamed, unknown, anonymous, is threatening to bring them down in cyberspace somehow. It's getting worse, Pastor. Is there a psychological angle? not just to the Westboro Baptist Church, but now to this anonymous threat.
Well, I mean, we're always trying to figure out how to solve our problems in life, and those people that see Fred Phelps a major problem, then, you know, they're going to try to figure out how to get around him or how to destroy him, since he seems to be wanting to destroy others.
But this leaves me with a quandary, because I think that the Westboro Baptist Church, personally, their behavior is so contemptible that I'm almost inclined to say, I don't care if you're anonymous, and I don't care if you know how to illegally hack into people's stuff. Go for it, because. But I can't defend that either. No. So I'm in quite a quandary here.
That's our old Adam. And again, keep your conduct among the Gentiles honorable, so that when they speak against you as evildoers, they may see your good deeds and glorify God on the day of the visitation. That's what we're doing even with Fred Phelps. I mean, I don't expect to see him in heaven. I don't think he's clinging to Jesus Christ as his Savior at all, even though he's claimed to be a Baptist. He's just out to legalistically change the behavior that he sees as being contemptible in the United States. And again, we speak out, too, publicly against many of the things that he speaks out against, but there's ways to do it that are right and ways to do it that are wrong. One of my colleagues who was a Baptist pastor in the city I served in Junction City, once told me that when he was over in Topeka, another friend of his went to speak to some of the Westboro Baptist people and thought that he could have a conversation with them. And this was apparently a man who had been converted from a bad lifestyle and stuff before, where he had heard all the various curse words and stuff and in his previous non-Christian life. And he came back and said, wow, those people taught me words that I've never ever heard before. You know, that just such horrendous sort of cursing and stuff that came at him in their misguided Christian thinking. And again, I just don't know what to... There's no good way to deal with them, just to continue to ignore them, do all we can to speak against them, to know that they're not speaking for the Christian faith, and to rev up our motorcycle engines. Two of my members of my congregation were actually those people that helped organize the motorcyclists that would go to these various funerals, and when the Phelpsites would get too loud, then they just rev up their motorcycles and drown them out with the noise.
We've got about 2 minutes left here. One more key question. Based on the discussion we've had here this morning, how many men are enrolled down here at Concordia Seminary right now?
Men and women.
Men. Well, we've been talking about father figures, so let's just stay with the men here.
570, something like that.
570?
570, something like that. So,
is it important? Do you make an effort to know these seminarians' experience with their fathers, with their upbringing? You have 25 men sitting in a class in front of you. This guy over here had a terrible father figure and terrible home life. This guy over here had a very stable and exemplary home life. Do you care? Is that private? You shouldn't even know that, because it'll cause you to form prejudices or biases. How do you deal with that?
Well, we do psychological testing of all the students. They take a battery of various tests when they come in, and then they process through those tests over time.
So what happens if, I take the test and it comes back, boy, this is Chuck Rathard. He had a terrible home life. His father beat him and stuff. You're going to put me on a track over here in a different direction? What are you
going
to do?
There's at least an advisor, a pastoral advisor, that's not even directly an employee of the seminary. He's actually employed by the synod, who has a responsibility to kind of process through each individual student with that. And in my class, pastor's counselor, we ask all students to go and do 5 sessions of counseling while they're in the class.
To be recipients of counseling.
To be recipients of counseling, so that they actually know what it feels like. And so I read lots of papers by those students that come back and go, oh, this was a really good experience. It helped me deal with, you know, whatever childhood experience or current experience that they were going through. I really encourage pastors to go and have a father confessor and a counselor that they can go to when they are pastors and when they are seminarians. So everybody can work through their issues. We just need to spend some time doing sales org work, even with ourselves.
I love that word. I still don't know what it means, but I'm working on it. I'm working on it. Thank you, Doctor.
Yep, very good to be with you, Chuck.
Dr. Rick Mars, he is a professor at Concordia Seminary here in St. Louis. In our second hour here, the Ask the Pastor Hour. Tomorrow, we'll move into Romans chapter 12. Our guest will be Pastor John Lukomsky.
Listen to Chuck Rathard and guest pastors Monday through Friday at this same time on The Bible Study. The Bible Study is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is needed for The Bible Study to continue. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can contact us on the web at kfuo.org. Download programs from the Bible Study archives at kfuo.org. The Bible Study is underwritten by Concordia Seminary, St. Louis.